The Financial Sense Midweek Edition with Jim Poplava. Delving in-depth with authors and experts into the key economic issues.
Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's edition of Lifetime Income.
And I'm John Loeffler. Our guest today is David Sein. He's Regional Administrator of Medicare and Medicaid Services in California. He's going to be joining Jim to discuss the topic of hospice care and Medicare, and that's, of course, coming up later on the show. But as this is tax season, it's probably the only other season other than silly season that we monitor directly here, we're going to turn our attention towards tax planning for high net worth individuals and highly compensated employees. With federal tax rates as high as 44% and both Democratic candidates proposing even higher tax rates, tax planning has become increasingly important for high net worth or highly compensated individuals. At present, combined federal and state taxes can confiscate as much as 57% of your income. And that figure, of course, could rise even higher depending on the outcome of this year's elections in November. So let's jump in and begin.
Well, you know, if you look at how wealth is created in a capitalistic society like the U.S., great wealth comes from four sources. One is entrepreneurship. Think of somebody like Bill Gates or, let's say, Steve Jobs starting a corporation and building enormous wealth. Another form of creating wealth is highly compensated employees or people in high-end professions. Think of doctors, surgeons, or, let's say, corporate executives. The third way, and you can make megabucks, is entertainment. Think of music stars, actors, or professional sports. And then, of course, John, the fourth way is you inherit it. So what we want to do today is focus on the highly compensated employee, let's say working at a public corporation. Now, one of the ways that companies compensate key employees is not only through, let's say, salary and bonuses, but something that's referred to as incentive stock options. Now, the use of stock options to compensate executives really grew significantly in the 1990s for a number of reasons. Number one, the big bull market. Remember back in the days when the stock market was going up 15% a year, and it seems like it'd be forever. And the other one was the result of a tax law that put a cap on employers' deductible compensation. And that was passed in 1993, where the government said, you know what, you can pay a corporate executive more than $1 million for a salary, but you're only going to be able to get a deduction for $1 million. So if you paid a guy $10 million was his salary, the corporation would only get a deduction for $1 million. So after Congress put a cap on corporate compensation, corporations increasingly began to use stock options as a main method to compensate key employees. You know, how do you get a top executive? How do you retain key employees? And like everything else in our complicated tax code, there's all kinds of various forms of stock option plans, each treated differently for tax purposes.
You know, I was thinking of the president's visit to Cuba this week and how, as there's always a scarcity of things, a black market always springs up. There's always a capitalistic enterprise, even in the middle of a totally socialistic system. It just reacts to the shortages in the system. It always amazes me, too, that like Congress passes a law to raise taxes, in this case, to limit the deductibility of an executive salary, and they were going to limit it at $1 million. So corporations come out with a way around that called stock options to circumvent the restriction. It's amazing. This is why the code is as complex as it is because as they would pass a law, people would say, oh, well, okay, well, we'll do it this way then. And then the government would say, well, you can't do that. Then they put in extra blocks. And before you know it, the code was as thick as we have. But ironically, it is the genius of a capitalistic system is that it still responds to supply and demand and always tries to find a clear way through to maintaining its wealth generation. So let's talk about stock options and their taxation and how this factors in.
Yeah. I mean, like anything else, as a result of the tax law, there are a number of variations of these plans that are out there. Now, what I want to do is basically cover the three main variations here, because there's different tax implications for different stock options. And there are three variations that are very popular today. One is called ISO. That stands for incentive stock option. There's NSO, which is a non-qualified stock option. And there's RSO, which is called restricted stock options. So there are other forms of incentive stock options, from restricted stock to stock appreciation rights to phantom stock plans. But John, if you take what most corporations use today, it's usually a variation of either ISO, NSO, or RSO, and every one of those has different tax implications in terms of when you pay the tax, how you pay the tax, and what kind of tax.
Okay, well, like so much of the tax code, you know, I can imagine it's complicated like everything else, right?
Really?
No, please don't tell me it's simple. Nothing can be simple.
No, it really isn't. I mean, let's begin, for example, with ISOs. That's individual stock option plan. Then ISO gives an employee the right to purchase a stock in a tax-favored manner. By law, the exercise or strike price for the stock must not be less than current market value of the stock. So let's say at the time the option is granted, the stock is selling at $10 a share. You can't give an option for $9 a share because you would have to recognize income. Now, here's a real key thing if you're a corporate executive listening to this. The tax advantage of an ISO plan to an employee is there is no income recognized when the company grants you the right for those stock options or even on the exercise of the price. So, for example, let's say they gave you the right to buy 1,000 shares at $10 a share. The market value of the stock is $10 a share. There's nothing recognized. And let's say down the road, you want to exercise those shares and buy the stock. And let's say the stock price is $20 a share. You don't pay any tax then either. When you do pay a tax, the only tax you're going to pay is when you actually sell the shares of stock, and then you're going to be taxed at a long-term capital gains rate, which is much more favorable. Now, there's all kinds of things that you have to go through hoops in order to make this thing work, because it's like anything else. You got to dot your I's, cross your T's, because there are a number of things that must happen. Number one, the company has to have a written plan, and that plan has to specify, for example, the number of shares that could be issued and which class of employees can receive them. The plan also has to be approved by shareholders. This is a big thing. It's usually put in the prospectus or at the annual shareholder meeting. The plan cannot exceed 10 years. In other words, they can't grant you these options beyond 10 years. They cannot be transferred except for a death. So let's say a husband was working at a corporation. He's granted these stock options and then he passes on. They can be transferred on to, for example, his family or his spouse. It also can only be granted to employees of the company. So a company can't issue these kind of stock options to vendors or special clients. The other thing is to qualify for capital gains. They must be held for at least 2 years from the date of the grant or 1 year from the date of the exercise. And like all good things, they did put a cap. No more than $100,000 of these kind of option grants can be given in any 1 year to receive these favorable tax treatments. So there is a limit of this $100,000. So they can't give you $1 million worth of stock options. They put a cap on it in any 1 year. But you could get $100,000 of stock option grants per year to receive this favorable treatment. And this is probably the most favorable stock option grant out there. But once again, there's a limitation on it of $100,000. So I'm afraid this is not going to be much use to Larry Lots of Bucks, a top executive. So when you see these things or you read them in the Wall Street Journal or you're watching CNBC and you're talking about executive compensation of $20 million or $15 million, most of that is coming from incentive stock options, the bulk of that, and it's going to be taxed at a less favorable rate. This most favorable rate is limited, unfortunately, to only $100,000 a year.
You know, I would imagine that what makes this particular type of stock option is that at the time of the option grant, there is no taxable income to the employee. And then when there is a taxable event, say, well, let's say, for example, the sale of the stock, it's taxed at the mere favorable capital gains tax rate versus the higher income tax rates on salary or bonuses. So that's the advantage of this whole thing. Now, what about other stock option plans?
You know, I want to spend just a moment of this because this shows you the folly of government planning, because they come in and they basically said, look, we're not going to give you a deduction if you pay a top executive of a corporation more than $1 million. And if you're running a Fortune 500 company or an S&P 500 company, you're doing a good job. Believe me, you can command high compensation. So the government comes in and says, look, we don't want you doing that. You're not going to get a deduction. What corporations do, they come up with incentive stock options. And in this case, the $100,000 is taxed at a much more favorable rate. But it just goes to show you, in a capitalistic system, you just, as you pointed out, John, you figure ways around it. And that's why this tax code has gotten to be so complex, because of all the special interest groups. They're always lobbying Congress for special deductions, not to mention the fact that Congress is always trying to get money somewhere, and the system just figures out a way around it. Now, the next common stock option plan is called the NSO, and that stands for a non-qualified stock option plan. Now, this plan is similar to the ISO in that it grants an employee the right to buy a company stock at a particular exercise price. Let's go back to the example I gave. Let's say at $10 a share. Now, the difference between the NSO and the ISO is the tax treatment at the time of exercise of the stock option. So let's say in that example, an employee is given the right to buy a stock at $10 a share. At the time the stock option is exercised, meaning that let's say the stock goes to $20 a share, the difference between the exercise price and the current market value of the stock when exercised, that difference is taxed as ordinary income subject to the higher income tax rates. So you're going to pay ordinary income taxes on the difference in the gain. Now, the exercise price then becomes the new tax basis for the employee. So if he exercises it at $20 a share, he pays the tax, $20 becomes his basis. And now there's an additional tax, just like the ISO, when the employee decides to, let's say later on, sell the shares. Let's say the stock goes from $20 to $30 or $40 a share. If he was to sell the stock at that time, then he would be subject to capital gains taxes. So under an NSO plan, there are two taxes. One, ordinary income taxes when the stock options are exercised, and two, capital gains taxes when the stock is actually disposed of when it's sold.
You know, what becomes clear to me is that ISOs are really clearly more favorable from a tax planning view, because the ISOs are taxed once, which is at the more favorable gains tax rate.
Well, I mean, the ISOs are probably the most favorable, but, you know, once again, there's limitations. You can only grant $100,000 per year to qualify. Anything over that, you can't get an ISO. So, you know, companies that'll pay their executives several million dollars in stock option grants, it doesn't work that way. So the employee's going to end up paying ordinary income taxes when he exercises. I mean, there is one other form of options that are used, which is probably more favorable for the company, but it's more unfavorable from a tax consequence, and that's called RSOs. These are restricted stock options. Now, under the RSO plan, an executive is given the right to receive actual shares of stock at a point in the future, provided, let's say, certain conditions are met. Usually they're, you know, some kind of incentive or tied to something that happens to the company stock or the company. The shares of stock are restricted until they become vested. Now, the disadvantage of RSOs is that once the shares are given, the entire value of the shares are treated as ordinary income. So let's say the company gives an employee, let's take that same example of the $10 stock. They give them 1,000 shares of stock at $10 a share. The entire value of that stock of $10 is now treated as ordinary income. and there would have to be a tax paid. And then secondly, once the employee sold those shares later on, there would be an additional capital gains tax. So rather than granting an option at $10 where there's no tax at the time the grant is given, when you give restricted stock, there is an immediate tax that would be due, or in the year that they were given, because that's considered actual constructive receipt according to IRS rules. And so it's actually, John, less favorable from a point of view of an employee, because there are greater tax consequences. Tax consequences when the grant is given, tax consequences when the stock is later sold. So there's less of a control for the employee under these circumstances. So there's actually more taxes usually paid under this type of a grant.
Okay, so out of all of these various stock option plans, which is the one which you say is the most favorable, has the best tax advantage for the employee?
I mean, the ISOs are probably the most favorable to the employee because there are no tax consequences to the employee when the company grants the options. And in addition to that, there are no tax consequences when the stock options are exercised. So the only tax you're going to pay is going to be a favorable capital gains tax. And so the employee has a lot more control over the taxes paid and is going to pay a lower tax rate.
All right, well, explain the difference between, let's say, the three different programs, and then we want to illustrate the tax consequences by doing that.
Well, I mean, let's take, I don't know, we'll call him Eddie Executive, who works for, let's say, ABC Corp, and let's say ABC stock is currently trading at $10 a share. Let's just keep the math simple, and that's its market value. So assume that ABC Corp grants Eddie Executive 1,000 shares at $10 a share. So let's look at the tax consequences of the three different options from, let's say, the least favorable to the most favorable. Now, as I just mentioned earlier, RSOs, or restricted stock options, are probably the least favorable. In this case, the company would actually transfer 1,000 shares of stock to the executive. The stock is worth $10 a share at, let's say, 1,000 shares. The employee would receive $10,000 of taxable income, and that would be taxed as ordinary income. There's no favorable tax treatment there. So that's the first tax. Secondly, later on, let's say the stock goes to, let's say, $20 a share, and the employee decides to sell the shares at that time, he would be subject to the more favorable capital gains rate, which today runs anywhere from 15% to 23.8%. Now let's go to the second type of situation, and that is a non-qualified stock option. In this case, the company issues the executive an option to buy 1,000 shares of company stock at $10 a share, and that's the market value at the time the grant is given. There are no taxes due on issuance of the stock grant, unlike the shares that were given in the previous example. At the time of the exercise, the option is granted. There is no tax consequences like an ISO or an RSO. However, let's say the stock does rise to, let's say, $20 a share. The employee decides, okay, I'm going to exercise the stock option. The difference between $10 and $20 a share, the point at where he exercises the option, that's $10 a share times 1,000 shares. That's basically $10,000. That would be $10,000 of ordinary income that the employee would have to recognize at the time he exercised the stock option. So that would be ordinary income taxed at the higher tax rates. And then once again, there would be an additional capital gains tax if the stock was later sold later on. Now, finally, the ISO, the one that we first started, that's the most favorable tax option because there are no taxes on the issuance of the stock options. Secondly, there is no tax on the exercise of the stock options. So the only tax would be upon the sale of stock, which would be subject to the favorable capital gains tax rate. And depending on the age of the executive, how long he holds this stock, there are certain estate planning advantages, depending on how the stock is held, where the capital gains actually could be forgiven at death. So there could be a situation, John, where there's absolutely no taxes at all. But out of all three, ISOs are probably the most favorable to the employee because of the lower tax rate. But once again, Congress has placed a limitation on that, limiting that amount to no more than $100,000 of stock option grants as ISOs in any one particular tax year.
You know what this shows? It really shows how complicated and complex our tax system has begun, despite the cry every single year, make this simpler, do something about this. It never seems to happen. And in each of these scenarios, the tax outcome is much different. This is what's amazing about the whole thing. So if possible, an executive or an employee should try to get their options issued as an ISO. I mean, that way, at least $100,000 of compensation can be taxed at the more favorable capital gains treatment rate. And once again, you know, a little financial planning can make a big difference in your after-tax income, which affects what you can invest, which affects what you can retire with. So tax planning, essential for what you're doing. Coming up very shortly, David Sein will be with us. He's Regional Administrator for Medicare and Medicaid, discussing hospice care and Medicare. But first, we're going to do our real-life case study, which we do every week here on the program. The real-life case study is based on a real-life case study. It actually happened. The only difference is we changed the names of the people involved to protect their privacy. So let's do it this week. I'm assuming it's going to be about tax planning and the things we've been discussing.
This is going to be a little bit more complex because this is a couple. We'll just call them Paul and Kathleen. Paul is a high-level executive with a health insurer company, and his wife, Kathleen, is a product manager. Paul's age 44. Kathleen is age 36. They plan to retire at age 60. Paul earns about $400,000 a year, $270,000 in salary and bonus, and the rest in stock options. And his wife, Kathleen, earns $101,000 per year as a product manager. That's salary and bonus. Now, a couple things going on here. They are on the personal side, and this comes from Paul's dad. They've got several rental properties they started to buy, and they're using real estate as a form of shelter because you can shelter your income or rents from, let's say, interest expense, property taxes, and depreciation. So they want, because of their high level of income, because if you take both their salaries combined, it's over $500,000 a year. They're in the higher Obama tax brackets of 44% on the federal side. And then they're also in the state of California on the 10.3%. So you're looking at over a 54% tax rate. So what they're looking at doing is starting a franchise system that would be a beauty salon. And it's basically how to get cash flow. They would buy the property, they would turn it into a salon. The beauticians that would work in the salon would pay a monthly rent for their chair. And the business is expected to produce a little over $100,000 of income in year one. And they plan on opening in 2 to 4 different locations. Paul owns 2 rental properties as well with monthly income. Their primary home is worth roughly about $2.3 million in West LA with about $1 million equity. They've got roughly about $1.4 million in investable assets, and the home is paid off and worth $500,000. So annual living expenses now in retirement is roughly about $10,000 a month, $120,000 a year. They are frugal and they are savers. And so what they wanted to do, they were using real estate to shelter part of the rental income. They understood that. They were looking at ways to expand that real estate and get tax sheltered income. So we suggested a number of things. Number one, they set up their company to own this real estate as a subchapter S. And the reason we did that is, number one, they could pay themselves salaries, set up individual 401k programs, and any income earned above that, especially as they add, they're figuring each location would generate about $100,000 cash flow. And any additional facility they would open up with the property, you're talking about $100,000. You open up three or four, that would be $400,000. So we suggested that they set up a subchapter S corporation, because anything above their salary taken out would be taxed at the more favorable dividend tax rate. The other thing that we suggested they do as well is they pay themselves salaries of roughly $18,500, which is the limitation you can also do in terms of 401k. So they could pay themselves $18,500 a year as salary. They can put another $18,500 a year in a 401k program and another $18,500 matching contribution. So they could each pay themselves $18,500. That would be roughly $37,000 a year. Matching that with a 401k, it would be $74,000 a year. And anything over that would be taxable at a dividend rate, which is much more positive. The other thing we suggested, they lease a car, which is also deductible. So we would have a car expense. We had a 401k plan. Now, the thing that we also did with Paul is Paul was getting mainly NSO stock options, part of his compensation package, $270,000 was salary, about another $120,000, $130,000 a year was coming in the form of stock options. So he just recently got promoted, and as part of his negotiation strategy, we suggested the company did have an RSU program so that the stock option grants would be changed to RSUs, so there would be no tax upon issuance of the grant, there would be no tax upon exercise of the grant, and then when Paul sold the shares, they would be taxed at a more favorable rate. And one of the reasons that was really important is they wanted to exercise some of those options and use it to put a considerable down payment on the commercial properties they were buying for the beauty salon franchise, because mainly they were using the salon franchise as a commercial cash flow operation to create cash flow income. So they wanted to put a substantial amount. And so basically, we were working with them and changing the more favorable stock option program from an NSO to an ISO. Now, going forward, Paul will work in compensation packages, because as he moves up further up the ladder with the company, the packages get richer, the stock options get greater, and so we'll be working with him on that. The other thing that we're doing is we're using these calculations based on rent and cash flow, how much to put down given, let's say, the cost to finance the properties. So a good portion of that income that they'll be receiving from each one of these locations will be non-taxable, because already they were in a 54-55% tax bracket for federal and state of California. The other thing that we did is put some of the rental properties in an LLC to limit liability. So a number of things that we used here, we used a special setup, a subchapter S, to minimize taxes where they'd be taxed at the dividend tax rate, which is more favorable than the 44% federal. We set up joint 401k programs with matching contributions, which would shelter a good portion of the income, because by the time they open up their fourth location, assuming this all works out to, let's say, $100,000 profit from each location, you're talking about, John, another $400,000 worth of income. So between the salaries, between the 401k, expensing a car, depreciation on the property itself, most of the income of this corporation is going to be sheltered or at least taxed at a lower rate versus, let's say, the more unfavorable federal tax rate and state of California rate. So here we were using a number of things to bring their taxes down, and also even on the stock option grants, have them more favorable and taxed at long-term capital gains instead of the ordinary income tax rate, which would be close to 55%.
And coming up next on the program, David Sine, Regional Administrator for Medicare and Medicaid in California, discussing hospice care and Medicare as lifetime income continues at FinancialSense.com.
You're listening to the Financial Sense Lifetime Income Program. To speak to Jim Poplava or his financial planning team, call us toll-free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized retirement portfolio.
Well, one of the major concerns as we age and head into retirement are medical expenses, everything from general health to long-term care and hospice care. Joining me on the program is David Sein. He is regional administrator at the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services here in California. David, once again, welcome back to the program. We're going to be talking about something that I think is extremely important. So it's good to have you back here. David, I want to start out today with the topic of hospice care. This is an issue that's getting more attention, and it's something that will be important to many baby boomers as they reach the end of their lives. Perhaps we should start out, what is hospice care exactly?
Sure. So hospice is a type of medical care that helps terminally ill people live the remainder of their lives as comfortably as possible. The focus is not on curing disease, and it's not just for people with cancer. Hospice is a difficult decision for people or loved ones, but it's an important care option that people need to know about. And Medicare does cover hospice care for Medicare beneficiaries.
And I'll probably want to get to in terms of the extent of the coverage, but how does this hospice program work? Is there a limitation? Is there a time period? Is there a copayment? Can you explain that?
Sure. There's several different angles to this. In terms of the cost, there's no deductible, so there's no first dollar payment. So if you elect hospice, then you're going to be getting your care now through this hospice provider. They'll handle your prescription drugs. You'll pay a copayment of up to $5 for those drugs that you need for pain or symptom management. There's a benefit for respite care to give your caregivers a break. You could choose to go into a facility for a few days. You'd pay 5% of the Medicare approved cost for that facility. And if you need inpatient hospice care, your hospice provider will make that arrangement. And the hospice provider will handle this with Medicare for you. They have a contractual arrangement. Typically, if you don't go through the hospice, you're going to make the arrangements for the care yourself. The way people find and get into this program usually is from social work, people at their physician's office or at the hospital making that reference. But there's also a national hospice and palliative care organization that has a website and lets you look up these providers based on your zip code.
Can a regular doctor be part of that team, David?
Oh, yes, absolutely. That's part of it. I mean, I think we're very committed to the relationship people have with their physicians, and that your doctor, maybe the person that refers you, doesn't have to be, but they're going to be a part of that team. But the hospice will have a nurse and physician available on call 24/7 in case, you know, you have a situation where you need that. The idea here is for you to be able to stay together in the comfort of your home, unless you really need to be in an inpatient facility for some reason.
I assume if you can stay in your home, the cost of care is much, much cheaper than it is, let's say, for being taken to a facility.
True. Many people that are having hospice care don't necessarily need to be in a medical facility anyway. The whole point is that, you know, they've decided that they want to go home and, you know, do what they want to do with the rest of their life instead of being poked with tubes in a facility. Yeah.
So I guess maybe the next question is, let's say if you're not going to be at home, or if you're at home or going to a facility, David, how do you find a good hospice provider? I mean, are there standards? Does the government have guidelines? You know, how do you find a good hospice provider?
Well, just to touch on your point before I turn to that, I did want to point out that there are people who are living, say, in assisted living and use a hospice benefit. The assisted living facility is their home. Home doesn't necessarily mean your house. Now, the way to find these organizations is, of course, on Medicare.gov or through 1-800-MEDICARE. They can help you find hospices in your area. And the national organization of the Hospice and Palliative Care Organization, NHPCO.org, they have a website that also will show you who the local providers are. They're pretty much everywhere. Many are local and voluntary in nature, and then there's some larger proprietary organizations that provide this work as well.
And I guess maybe the next question is, given that you may need hospice care, who qualifies for hospice care? Are there certain tests that have to be met, certain requirements before you get hospice care?
Sure. So this is a benefit that's really intended for people who have decided to no longer have a life-preserving or curative treatment because that doesn't seem like the right choice for them. And so when they apply to be in hospice, your doctor or a hospice physician would certify that, in fact, you're now expected to live beyond 6 months. And if that's the case, you go in the hospice. The hospice is going to provide palliative care for your comfort, which extends beyond just the thing Medicare usually covers. There's social work there. There's a bereavement counseling. There's work with your family and so forth. And you sign a statement that says, I'm choosing hospice care instead of my otherwise covered treatments that Medicare would cover for treatment of my terminal illness or related condition.
Now, can somebody get out of hospice care if they want to?
Yes, you can change your mind, stop the hospice benefit immediately, go right back into your Medicare benefits as you have them, either in Medicare Advantage or in fee-for-service Medicare.
And what sort of specific hospice services does Medicare cover? I mean, what is covered with the program?
Sure, that's very important. So the first thing that's covered is a consultation with the hospice medical director to determine if this is right for you and if you want to do this and to develop a plan for the management of your situation. You could have the consultation and it's paid for by Medicare. And if you decide to not get the hospice care, that's fine too. And after that, you've got your coverage for drugs that you need for to manage your comfort and your situation. As I mentioned, there's some social work care. There's some work that they'll do in the home to help, like, sort of manage your situation, home care, if you will. And that's generally what we think of as hospice.
And what about your spouse in the case, let's say, with a married couple or, let's say, other caregiver needs a break?
Well, that's right. That is very important. And so what the program provides for is what we call a respite period of up to 5 days where you could go into either an inpatient hospice facility, because some of the hospices have those, or a nursing home or other kind of facility to give your family a little bit of a break. And that's a 5-day benefit each time you get it, and you pay a percentage of that. For example, if Medicare paid $100 a day, your copayment would just be 5% or $5.
Yeah, I was going to say, when you talk about costs, what do you pay for all this as a Medicare beneficiary?
Other than what I just mentioned is the copayments for inpatient care, there's no special premium for the hospice benefit. If you're eligible for Medicare and you have Medicare Part B, you know, you're eligible to have this benefit. There's no additional cost.
So give me an example. Like you mentioned 5%. So if Medicare approves, let's say, $100 per day for inpatient respite care, you would pay, in this example, only $5. Is that correct?
Right. That's correct.
How long can someone get hospice care? You mentioned life expectancy in hospice is generally 6 months. Is that the extent of the coverage? And if it is the extent of the coverage, what happens if, let's say, a person lives 9 months or more?
Well, you know, I often have conversations with folks that wonder about what happens to people at the end of their lives, the services that they consume and so forth. And of course, it's a binary thing. If you're alive, you're alive. And who knows what's going to happen. So there are people that will be certified for the 6 months and they'll go on ahead and they'll live beyond that. They can be certified for another hospice period. So it's done in 90-day periods. And after the first two 90-day periods, then there would be 60-day periods to be certified that you still are eligible to continue to get hospice care. I have a good friend whose mother lives with him. She's 100. She was in hospice for a very long time. And then it was like, no, she doesn't need to be in hospice because she's 100 years old, but she seems to be doing okay. They thought she had a problem that she managed to get past. So that does happen. But most people are in there for a relatively short time. Majority of people that choose the benefit are people who are gravely ill.
Well, David, let me change gears on you, and I want to turn to another subject. And this was a new benefit that came into being in the last decade, and that's Medicare's coverage of prescription drugs. Tell us about that program, which is commonly known as Part D now of Medicare.
Sure. So back in 2006, that was when this program started, Medicare can help beneficiaries to pay for prescription drugs if they sign up for this prescription drug benefit. And we say that folks who may not be taking prescription medicines now, you may need them in the future. Some of them can be very expensive. So we recommend that all Medicare beneficiaries take advantage of the prescription drug benefit.
And how does someone get that drug coverage? Do they do that at the time they apply for Medicare?
That's what we recommend. And they can do it in one of two ways. There are people who choose the original Medicare fee-for-service benefit. They can choose from a number of prescription drug Part D plans that are standalone plans where there'll be a monthly premium. There may be some payment that you have to make at the pharmacy, and your plan will have a list of the drugs that they cover and the price points that they cover them at. Some, there's more participation than others. And that's one of the important things, is you do need to make sure that if there are medications that you know you need, that they're provided on the formulary or the list of drugs covered by your plan at a price point that you're comfortable with.
What's the other way? Like, I'm assuming, for example, like, let's say somebody's been on Medicare before Part D was added in the last decade. What's the other way to get drug coverage?
Well, an individual that has been in Medicare for a while, if they're in fee-for-service, traditional original Medicare, then still their choice would be to choose one of these standalone plans. But down in your area, almost half the people with Medicare are in these private plans that we call Medicare Advantage plans. Some of them are HMO kinds of plans. Some of them are PPO plans. And those plans, almost all of them, offer prescription drugs as part of the package that they offer. And they integrate the prescription drug benefit with the health benefits that they offer in their plans. They, too, often charge a monthly premium. And that premium is in excess of what you would pay for Medicare Part B. But those Medicare Advantage plans offer a pretty significant value. You see more and more people choosing them.
And is there a specific time when you can sign up for these Medicare plans? I know that, for example, when you're signing up for Medicare, there's, what, 3 months before the month of your birthday and 3 months afterwards, and then there's a Medicare enrollment period. So is there a specific time for this?
Yes, there is. So other than making initial enrollment in that six-month period that flanks your birth month, there's an annual open enrollment period that this year will begin on October 15th. And so from October 15th to December 7th, we have what we call Medicare open enrollment season. And that's when a person can opt into a prescription drug plan or choose to join a Medicare Advantage plan or a different one.
And how much do these drug plans typically cost?
It's a challenge because, like all insurance, they structure their benefits somewhat differently. So you're balancing the medications that a particular plan covers, the pharmacy that the benefits are available at, and for individuals, they may be eligible for some extra help from the government in defraying the cost. But as I said before, most of those standalone prescription drug plans do charge some monthly premium, which would be in addition to the Part B premium. They tend to be in the $30 range. And if you're in one of those private Medicare Advantage plans like Kaiser or Secure Horizons, they may also have a monthly premium that includes both the prescription drugs and maybe some other benefits as well. Most of these plans have a deductible, so some amount of dollars you're going to spend, could be 50, could be 100, before the plan begins to pay. So that's what you would pay before your share begins. And there may be a yearly deductible, and there may be some co-payment that when you're at the pharmacy, you may have to spend a few dollars there as well.
This seems like a very good place to talk about the donut hole. Can you explain what that is and how it works?
Yeah, it's a challenge that will not go away. When they created this benefit, they wanted to help people with their prescription drug benefits, but they also wanted to help people who had catastrophic drug expenses, people with leukemia or cancer, very expensive drugs. And there wasn't a way to really meet both policy objectives at the same time financially. So if the benefit's not available early on to anyone, no one's going to buy the coverage. So what they did is they created a benefit structure where you're going to get help to pay for your first roughly $3,300 worth of covered drugs. And then after that, the plan stops paying. You get a discount for drugs that you need in that period, but nonetheless, the plan doesn't pay until you've spent $4,850. And then your coverage comes back and it jumps all the way up to 95% of the cost. So that's that catastrophic benefit.
Do Medicare drug plans cover every drug that's on the market, or are there limitations, or do they, for example, suggest substitutions, for example, if there's a generic drug that's available?
What happens is all of the plans have to have drugs in all of the classes that we require, so they're all the common prescription drugs, but as you know, in some classes there are private label drugs that may be more expensive than the generic drugs, and different plans will cover those at different price points. So they may have two different tiers where the percentage that they pay toward the medication is different. Now, the plan isn't going to substitute you for one drug for another. That's a decision for you and your physician to make. But obviously, these benefit structures do encourage generic substitution. And ever since the program has started, we've seen a constant increase in the use of these generic medications, which we think is a good thing.
And what about things like extra help programs?
Well, that is a program where for people that have a relatively low income, and that's around $17,820 annual income for an individual, $24,000 for a couple, with that, your costs are going to be less. And your cost for a generic drug is going to just be a $2.95 copay and $7.40 for a brand name covered drug. And so that's a very helpful thing for a lot of people. There is a modest resource requirement of $13,000 that doesn't include your home or your burial plot or your car. It's just, you know, money or stock value, you know, dollar negotiable money that you may have. So, you know, that's a great program, and we encourage people to explore that because a lot of people don't know it's available.
Well, it seems there are a lot of benefits here that we've covered a good number of them, and especially things that have been added over the years. We talked about a hospice today and, of course, the new Part D drug program. David, if individuals would like to find out more information about the programs that we have been discussing here, tell them how they could do so, please.
Sure. It's really pretty easy. We have 24-hour telephone operators at 1-800-MEDICARE on the phone dial. They're there to help you. And then we have an internet site called medicare.gov. And there you can find out what Medicare coverage is. You can find doctors in your area. You can find hospitals, health plans, and compare the quality of those institutions and the availability as well. And I really encourage people to take advantage of those information sources.
Okay, and that toll-free number is 1-800-772-1213. David, once again, thanks for joining us on Lifetime Income. Some great information here.
Thank you very much.
You know, it was interesting how we were talking earlier about stock options, stock option plans, and it's amazing the dramatic way in which they can actually reduce tax liability based on whatever kind of a plan you have, how complicated the system is. But remember, this all came about as a method of limiting what it is corporations could pay their executives, and whoosh, they found a way around it. And that's why this whole thing just becomes nothing but a very complicated game. And to be honest with you, only people with high levels of income can actually afford to play it.
You know, it is getting more complex. And the problem is that each year they pass laws, they pass special exemptions for rewarding various favors that politicians give to those that support their campaign. And it's one reason, John, that basically, our tax code has gotten so complex. I mean, even the Social Security bill, which we've talked about, that was passed last November, they're still trying to figure this whole thing out. So it is really becoming burdensome, but I guess it creates a lot of business for tax lawyers and tax accountants because it is a complex system. We are going to continue this series on highly compensated individuals and high net worth individuals in terms of tax planning. We kind of touched a little bit about it in the case study this week with subchapter S and various things that we can do. We'll be talking about deferred comp programs, other types of programs that can help high net worth individuals shelter part of their income. Because let's face it, folks, the federal tax rate is 44%. Both Sanders and Clinton are talking about raising that even further. And also in the state of California, the state income tax was raised twice in the last 4 years. It's 13.3%. You add 13.3 to 44 federal, not counting Social Security tax. And, you know, you're talking about 57% where the government is taking more of your earned income than what you take home yourself, the wage earner. So we'll be talking about methods to get around this and minimize this because that's what they're put in place. These are provisions that are put in law, perfectly legal, and we'll be talking more about that in the weeks ahead. In the meantime, well, we're out of time. On behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on Lifetime Income. Until we talk again, we hope you have a pleasant week.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSN. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.